Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. After leading New Life Fellowship Church for 26 years, my guest Pete Scazzaro co-founded Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, a groundbreaking ministry that moves the church forward by slowing the church down in order to multiply deeply changed leaders and disciples. Pete is the author of a number of best-selling books, including The Emotionally Healthy Leader and Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. Pete and his wife, Jerry, also developed the Emotionally Healthy Discipleship Course, a powerful resource that moves people from a shallow to a deep relationship with Jesus. Pete and Jerry remain vital members of New Life Fellowship Church in Queens, New York. Pete's new book is Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, Moving from Shallow Christianity to Deep Transformation. Pete, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Shane, thank you. It's an honor to be in any podcast that is called Seminary.
I wonder, for those who maybe aren't completely familiar with your work, if you could give us the history of these books. You know, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, I believe, was the first one, correct?
No, but I'll give you.
Okay. Well, then tell me. You tell me.
Yeah. So, you know, the way our book kind of flowed out, I planted a church here, and after I didn't drop out of seminary, Shane. So,
well, there's still time,
but I need, I was a former InterVarsity staff person, eventually went to seminary, spent a year in Latin America, and then planted a church here in Queens, New York, called New Life Fellowship. And then about year seven or eight, hit a big wall, crashed. Basically everything I'd learned in seminary and leadership conferences and within my traditional or classic evangelical, you know, from conversion to that point, just wasn't adequate to lead the church, to follow Jesus in our insane world. And our context here was quite intense because, again, being in Queens, New York, very multiracial, working class, you know, it was an intense environment, a lot of racial tensions. So we hit this wall. And again, it was a personal wall. It was a leadership wall. It was a marital wall. It was walls all around. But God met Jerry and I in a very amazing way. And we began this, you know, journey. It really was the grace of God and integrating what we call emotional health and spiritual maturity and that whole connecting the two. And we realized it really was the missing parts of, I would call, the church in America, or the church globally today, missing pieces that we began to go after. And so that was 1996. Our lives were radically transformed. We call it a second conversion. And so I didn't write anything for 7 years. A good friend gave me a great advice and said, let it age like good wine. Just live it out, Pete. You know, so next 7 years, we just kind of lived out what we were experimenting with all kinds of things here. Things from, you know, genograms, your family of origin, how it impacts you, began to develop some relationship skills to integrate theology, limits. We began to integrate monasticism, silence, stillness, Sabbath. But we were doing it all just in our local church, pioneering it, and being in the inner city in New York, anything went. So it didn't matter. You know, it was no opposition. It was like, yeah, whatever, Pete, you know, we'll give it a shot. And, so then in 2003, because it was so powerful, I wrote it down in a book for pastors only. It was called The Emotionally Healthy Church. And they didn't want the title Emotionally Health. And Zondervan, I remember they said, no one's ever going to buy this, especially no men are going to buy it. But it really, the reason it had to be called Emotional Health was because it came, initially it was, you know, we're made in the image of God, an Old Testament professor. I went back to one of my professor, I said, how did I get into this mess where I almost crashed and burned? And I had a course in Augustine with this guy, and he said, because it's your Neoplatonism, you know, your whole understanding of what it means to be human, And that for many reasons, we neglect the emotional component of who we are as human beings. And that was kind of like my work. Like, what does it mean to get at the emotional piece? So that's why, how do I integrate feelings in discerning God's will? How do we get at my family of origin, 3 to 4 generations? How do we do connection, attachment, bonding, limits, loving well, like all that stuff. So that was like my, I finally wrote in a book called Emotionally Healthy Church. And that was 18 years ago. And although no one bought it, you know, initially, it just began to kind of spread word of mouth, you know, and it kind of really grew. And then, but that was just for pastors. And then I wrote Emotionally and Spirituality, which was for everybody, a few years later. And that became like really gigantic, which I thought I was going to get crucified for it, you know, but I didn't care. All I knew was God was doing something in our midst that was significant. And I felt it was important to record it. And I tried to, you know, you write, Shane, but only write what you're living type of thing. That was one of my commitments. And it was the integration of monasticism along with emotional health. And at that point, I'd gone and got my doctorate in ministry and marriage and family. Not that I wanted to be a therapist, but I wanted to integrate some of the stuff therapists were doing into discipleship. So it's been, I was learning from Trappist monks. I was getting my, you know, doctorate of ministry and marriage and family. So it's kind of the family systems along with monasticism combination in a multiracial situation. And so, and really this, and so we've been unfolding this ever since. We you know, in terms of at New Life was kind of our, over the first 26 years was actually pioneering. How do you actually do this? And then when I stepped down 8 years ago, began to, our church commissioned us to bring this to the world. And so the book, this book, Emotionally Discipleship, that you received, that came out just a month ago, is actually a rewrite of Emotionally Healthy Church. Because it's 18 years later, the issues have changed. When I wrote that first book, no one had ever heard the term emotional health. Like that was like, so I wrote it very differently and the issues have changed. And so it needed, it ended up being like, not just a rewrite, it was an 80% new book. So we just, we get Emotionally Church is like off the shelf. It doesn't exist anymore. And this is like, this is written, but this book is written actually meant to be for leaders, you know, thinkers, pastors, leaders. It's a very specific audience. And because it's a theology of a whole other way to do church. It's a paradigm. It's, I call it a new operating system. And it's like church as we know it is just, it's just over. And I just, at this point, I'm old enough, Shane, I'm like, what do I care? You know, I'm just like, let's just call it what it is. And basically it's an invitation to say, if you've got the guts to do this, it's going to be very hard and long and difficult, but it's very liberating. I invite you to build and lead differently. And so emotionally discipleship is really in a sense, the, I call it, the pillars of building a church culture or ministry culture that really changes people. So it's meant to be kind of like in your face, very direct, but grounded so that, I mean, I wrote very much aware that this book will probably be around in 15, 20 years. So it needs to be wrestled with, disagreed with. And really it's the fruit of 26 years of living this thing out and thinking about it. So yeah, I feel really good, like having gotten off my chest, you know, like, okay, it's done. So I feel great about it. I'm like, it's a win that it's done.
I've told you, I've been following you for a while. I got it wrong. I thought you wrote Emotional Spirituality first, but I think that's because it kind of overshadowed the first one, which kind of flew under the radar a little bit. And so it makes sense that you would circle back now with this. So you would you say for the average person in the pews, maybe emotionally healthy spirituality is where they should start?
Absolutely. Yep. That's where they should start.
And then pastors and leaders should probably still read Emotional Healthy Spirituality, but that this book is for them, Emotionally Healthy Discipleship.
Yep. Yep. Yes. But just, you know, Shane, for us, it's not reading a book's just a bunch of ideas. We recognize you got to lead people into doing life differently, discipleship differently. And so that's why we developed this course, an experiential course of like, you're doing daily offices, you're doing silence and stillness every day. You know, that's to us is, I don't want people writing papers about my books. You know, it's like that to me is like, that doesn't change anybody. It's just intellectual gymnastics. It's almost so you can almost use your intellect to defend yourself away from changing. You know what I mean? It's a way of, it's a defensive posture. I'm thinking about it, but you're not actually, there's nothing in your heart being engaged feeling wise. And I just don't have much time for that.
Well, I mean, I think that if people take the message of the book to heart, I mean, part of the book is the orthopraxy, right? Like you can't embrace the book without embracing the orthopraxy.
Did you read it? Did you get a chance? I know you just got it, I'm assuming.
The new one? Yeah. Not like cover to cover, but yeah, I got it.
Okay, good. Okay.
And you've been, we can talk about this a little bit later, but you've also been going through this on your podcast as well, kind of fleshing out these things, which I recommend. And we'll put links on the show notes and everything. I wonder if you gave kind of the sketch, but I wonder if you could dive briefly but deeply into like what prompted this in your life. Like I think you were finding that you were meeting some external benchmarks of success in your church, and yet there are some things lacking in your own life, like the things that happened in the 90s that brought that along.
Yes. Well, the shame on the external events happening, it was God trying to get my attention that something was really wrong internally. Okay. I wasn't listening. So everything from just being stressed out, just living a pace of life that was just so unenjoyable. So on a personal level, one, I was emotionally exhausted, just leading a church, working way too much. I had four small daughters at the time. And, you know, I wasn't available for my wife. We were friends for 8 years before we got married, and she's amazing. And I loved her, but she didn't feel it. I was loved. So, she didn't feel love. So she was unhappy in the marriage. And you know, again, we were living on a street with like drug dealers and prostitutes, you know, and she's like, I'm a single mom here with four kids. Mm. And she was trying to get my attention, but I wasn't listening. So our marriage was not going well. We were stable, but unhappy, like most couples, you know, and then one of our congregations had a split. And I was so enraged by this, you know, churches has an ugly side, but when you go through a church split, you really see the ugly side of church. Like every demon comes out of the walls, you know, and I never really, you know, I came to Christ at 19, so I'd never really seen something so horrific in a church. And again, we were one church in two languages, English and Spanish. And it was our Spanish section that's 200 people left to start another church. And listen, Shane, I come from an Italian-American family from New York, you know, like I was going to call my family and say, let's get this guy and break a couple of legs, send a message, you know, and so I was on a theological crisis because I really did hate this guy for doing what he did to me, this betrayal. So I was such an internal mess at this point. I was depressed. I started going to therapy. I don't even believe in therapists, but I was so depressed. I had nobody to talk to. And I started to pay attention to what was going on inside of me, because it was so intense I couldn't deny it any longer. And so that got me therapy. Is like slowed the pain, slowed me down from my marriage, my personal life, my theology. It was clear to me that evangelicalism as I knew it does not deeply change people, because we saw recycling the same old problems. And because we were in a multiracial situation, it was very obvious to us that we don't change people deep enough to deal with racism. It just, I mean, for a Chinese person, a light-skinned Latino person, African-American, white person, all to be in the same group, really be friends. I mean, come on, like to actually to live in Queens. Yeah. Everybody wants to follow Jesus as long as they can have their McMansion and a comfortable life and their kids are in great schools. I realized this is all just perfunctory. Mm. And I just realized I'm not going to give my life to this. The gospel doesn't deeply change people. Then why am I wasting my time? So I would say a number of crises all came together. And I just knew God had brought us here to Queens to do what we were doing. I just didn't know why it was going so badly. You know, it was going horrific. But it was God. Do you understand? It was God brought us to the bottom. And then when Jerry, you know, a bit of the story, in 1994 is when everything started falling apart. I'm going to therapy for basically almost a 2-year period at that point. And I'm kind of, you know, pieces are coming together. And then I really hit bottom. You know, when you think you're at the bottom, but you're not at the bottom. I thought I was at the bottom in 94. I wasn't at the bottom. I was at the bottom 2 years later when Jerry says, I quit. I'm going to another church. And she starts going to my friend's church, okay, here in another part of Queens. And she actually, I mean, she left. And, you know, that was a bad moment. Now, there wasn't a question of us getting divorced, but I was going to have to move to New Jersey. Okay. It was like, we're getting out of here. Cause I'm not basically saying I'm not participating in your pathology anymore. I'm just not doing it. Jerry's integrity saved my life. Seriously. She saved my life. She said, I'm not doing this anymore. So that really got me to therapy. Like, you know, there's therapy and it's therapy. Now I'm like, we're in full crisis. We went away for a week to these two therapists and us. That's when I realized what an emotional infant I was. It was so embarrassing. I realized how immature I was, what a jerk I was. And so I, you know, I came to her and said, you know, all right, I'm going to take a sabbatical because I had to get my life together. I can't lead anybody. I'm trying to raise up, we were planting churches. We were raising up leaders, like leaders as immature as me. You know what I mean? What am I reproducing? That's what's really sad. We were multiplying dysfunctional groups and churches. Okay, mm-hmm. That's all. But we were multiplying. We checked the box. So we basically hit such a rock bottom, Shane. We went on a 3 to 4 month sabbatical, and we came back, and we had changed. We developed some really new ways of functioning. You know, rhythms, Sabbaths, leading out of our marriage became a big theme. And we came back to New Life and we said, well, if everybody leaves the church, it's fine. We were like, because we had been to hell at that point, but we knew we were not doing the church thing anymore. Our big thing, Shane, was no more lying. That, because we lied a lot. We lied. In fact, most of the church was a lie. How are you? Good. How's church? God's moving. You know, you just spin everything. How you feeling? I'm good. You know, all that. And we made a commitment to not lie anymore to ourselves. We wouldn't lie to each other and we weren't going to lie to anybody else. That. And so every day I would go to church when we first got back and I said, okay, Joe, I'm going to go to church, honey. And I'm not going to lie today. She goes, good luck. That was the beginning. And so that was the beginning of emotionally healthy discipleship. So, okay, here we go. And so very slowly we began to just like bring it. But I really mean it. Like we were really okay if everybody left the church. We just weren't going to do religion anymore. We weren't going to do like, you know what it's like. Everyone's just praising God and prophesying, but they're defensive and angry and proud and judgmental. And so we got to call these people. And I said, no, we don't do this here anymore. And so I began to, I didn't do conflict prior to this. I just began to call and say, no, we don't do this here in New Life anymore. The new family of Jesus. We don't judge people. You know, we're teachable, you know, et cetera, you know, and we measure spirituality by humility and approachability and safety and love. Like that's the measure of real spirituality. That was quite a shift. You know, we were a good charismatic Pentecostal church, you know, and so we shifted the paradigm slowly. And but honestly, most importantly, we were gonna lead from a cup that overflows. We were gonna really enjoy ourselves. We didn't like the church. You know, it had to change. Like we had to love the church we were pastoring, like love it, and that meant no nonsense. Like basically, no, that person's not gonna lead. I don't care if they got a seminary degree or gifted, they're anointed prophetically, or they fast twice a year for 40 days each. And they're you feel worse when you're with them. Mm-hmm. And we just began to acknowledge it. Like when I'm with this person, I feel worse. Like that's not Jesus. Okay. And just saying that's not Jesus. Like, no, like this person's not going to be in leadership like that. So we had hit such a bottom. We came out just saying, it doesn't matter anymore. And so then we began to just go slowly in 1996 and build. And it's been 26 years. It's been a wonderful journey. It's been fantastic, been fun, enjoyable. And I've really liked being a pastor. It's, you know, I mean, I'm not lead pastor anymore. That's nice. But I did it 26 years. It was a great journey. And I like leadership. I enjoy it. But like you're doing your podcast, you love it, right? I read that in your bio. You enjoy it. It's great. That's how I feel. I enjoy it. I have a sense of God's hand on it. And I'm like, good. But it's an interior freedom. And I continued, I'm growing and we're still growing and learning. And we live monastic rhythms personally and as a couple, and we lead out of our marriage. And yeah, we're growing as much now as we ever have in our Christian life. And it's been fantastic.
There's a lot to unpack there. I want to talk about a few things that you brought up. I love that you said evangelism does nothing, is not strong enough, doesn't go deep enough to change racism.
Yeah.
I mean, you're really like speaking my heart language, because that is something that bothers me greatly about modern Christianity, especially in the United States. And I think that what that goes along with kind of the heart of emotionally healthy spirituality, because what you were finding was that the things that we said made a successful church, or what a successful church looks like, you could have that and people can be internal wrecks, right? Like people can, they can be deceitful. They can be guarded. They can be completely out of touch with their true selves. Their marriages are awful. Who they are behind closed doors is not who they are in front of people. And how prophetic is this, keeping in mind the last couple of years with what the Me Too movement has exposed in our churches, these people that we looked up to that had these just shocking inner lives that we didn't know about. Like we've really, it's come home to roost in the church.
Yes. Yeah. And so as long you could, we want to repress you, right? Repress your stuff, shove it down. But you want to be in a small group. You want to be listening to sermons. You want to be in worship. You want to be doing mission trips. And it's repression. And that's why are we surprised that people in their 50s and 60s blow up? Because underneath it all, there's not been any change. They're still angry, defensive, judgmental. Think of the seven deadly sins, envious, jealous, because we suppress it. And we just want to just hold it together. We got to build this church. And it's sad. It's American Christianity. It's American Christianity. And I just, we saw it. We're like, okay, we're leaving that. We used to say, leave the world and leave the American church. And follow Jesus. But if your goal is numbers, is to have a crowd, you can get a crowd. You don't even need Jesus to build a crowd. Get a great worship band, throw a smoke machine in there, you can have program. You can build things that people want to build community, and you build it. But it doesn't mean you're building a transformative community where people are meeting Jesus. I mean, I think
that's right.
That's a very different church. That means it's got to flow out of your inner life.
Yeah.
So we hire technicians who are great speakers or great with graphics and PowerPoints, and doesn't mean they're walking with God, but they have great technical skills. And that to me is just a tragic tragedy. So that's why it's taking me back to some of the history of the church, and the church history and the church fathers. And you realize in the church history, like the American Christianity is like a thin sliver of this 2000 years of church history around the world. And it's just all going to disappear because it's built on smoke. And I think we're seeing all these scandals, all the Black Lives Matter, Asian Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, the pandemic, all these cascading waves of pain of crashing over the church. And the numbers of young people that are just leaving church is just enormous. But I think God's trying to get our attention. I don't think it's a bad day. I think it's a good day. I think God's doing something. It's just not what we wanted or liked,
Well, I think you're right. I think the young, especially younger generations, are looking at things in the church, things that you were talking about, the deceit, the guardedness, all of that, and saying, and unfortunately, many are saying, I don't want to have anything to do with Christianity at all, if that's what it looks like. So I wonder if one of the things that you know, in the book, Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, the new one, before we get to the, like, well, what do? I think there's some things that we have to unlearn. So, like, what are some things that people, that churches are doing that we call discipleship that we need to unlearn or just, you know, stop doing that have not served us well?
That's a big question, Shane. I mean, I've got to unlearn everything. I mean, for the most part, what happens is we still do life the way we were raised and the way our culture does life, the American culture. And so I have, we come to Christ, we accept Jesus, which is good. And then we start going to church and we're in small groups and connecting and on Sundays. But it's shallow. I think the word for me is it's like an inch deep. And so what we're doing is good. It's not something to like get rid of it. I really do believe that the local church is the most important institution in the world, to be honest. Jesus, when he came to Jerusalem, went right to the temple, because the temple is the most important place in the city, in our communities. He didn't go to City Hall. He didn't go to Herod's Palace. He didn't go to Rome. But what does it mean to follow Jesus? I think, to me, it's a relationship. Okay, and so we have to leave both our family of origin and the American culture, how we define success, how we define our goals, what's great in life, trying to impress people, being popular, all that stuff, like, and get serious about a relationship with Jesus, you know, versus riding on autopilot. Like, I believe intellectually and I'm fine. And allowing Jesus to change us. So that's why, for me, certain aspects of our lives have to be grounded, such as I've got to build into my life like silence and stillness, yeah, and solitude. That's like the noise. The world is so incredibly noisy. I've got to build that in. So there's time for the scripture. There's enough quietness for God to come to me and things to actually penetrate my life. And I'm willing to go on this journey of learning to feel and letting God into my motives and all that ugly stuff in there, so he can begin to sort that out. But I've got to draw from out. I got to draw from other places than kind of these American churches with rock bands and that kind of thing. I've got to like expand the horizons of discipleship beyond that.
So you're mentioning two things that you name in the book, which one is an emphasis on doing rather than being. So, man, I know of so many churches that you just feel like they think, like they had a meeting and they're like, if we can just give people so much to do, maybe they won't have time to sin. like if we could just program every single, you know, hour of their life and give them something to be at, to volunteer at, whatever. And that's how we'll measure our success. X number of people participated here and there. The next thing that you said was the emphasis away from one, the American church, and even our recent history. So this is something I love about what you emphasize in your writings, is that there is so much of the church that is not white American evangelicalism, talking about both globally and then historically, like how many people don't know about what our church fathers taught, you know, for good or for bad. And I feel like one of the things that breaks my heart is that when people are leaving the church because they don't like what they see the modern church doing, is that no one's clued them in to how the global church, how the historic church was so much different and functioned so differently.
Absolutely. I mean, the church is, it's a big church. I remember when ISIS beheaded those 19 Christians, the Coptic Christians on the beach in Libya. They were in orange suits and like, these are Coptic Christians from Egypt, and the Egyptian church is a whole 2000 years of martyrdom as part of its history. But like, you look at that, and I had somebody making a judgment on them. Oh, you know, but they have a pope, the Coptics, they're patriarch, and they wear robes. And I was just like, you're making a judgment on their spirituality as they're being beheaded from your suburban, white, middle class home? Two cars? I'm like, you're kidding. So there's something, you know, so crazy about even the way we've been politicized, you know, the church being in throughout church history, when the church has ever been politicized, it's always led to a disaster. Whenever the church is aligned with any government, right or left. But the American church is so split politically is such a symptom of our shallowness, because we don't belong to any political party. We belong to Jesus. There are aspects in which we may have aligned with one political party over here, or maybe another political party over here, but we're aligned to something that transcends all this. And we have been used in the United States by politicians for decades. Now it's a full-blown divisive church war, which I don't think is going to go away in the next 5-10 years. But again, we're back to, this is an inner life issue. This is a discipleship issue. This is Shane, there's no quick answer to this thing, but but I think it's a wake up call. If I had any image to me, which I like the best, is the desert. Things are of such a crisis point in the American church in particular, that it's like this, it's like when the desert fathers in the 3rd and 4th centuries, when the church became part of the Roman Empire, the church had become so worldly inside the church. It was so much of the world inside the church that you really couldn't distinguish inside the church and outside the church. Like, there wasn't a big difference between the two. And I think that's where we're living today. And so you had these men and women who fled to the deserts of Egypt and Syria to get to God. And it was a radical decision to say, I got to get cleansed of the idols in my heart, and I got to get to God no matter what it costs me, so that I can cleanse the church of her idols and hopefully bring Jesus to the world. I'm really convinced that it's going to take that kind of radical decision for all of us to say, I'm really leaving the values of our culture, and I'm going to do whatever it takes me. I'm going to get to God. One of my daughters said to me, what do you, Dad? You want me to get up 4:30? Their kids get up 5:30 in the morning. We're talking about our need for greater contemplative life, silence in our life. So what do I do? Get up 4 a.m? She says to me, 4:30. I said, I don't know. I said, I just know your anxiety is through the roof and you need a deeper inner life to handle what's coming at you right now. In this pandemic, whatever it takes, I got to get to God. Because it's life and death. It's at that level. And I think when you see the drasticness of the decision, then I say, oh, then everything is, once I make that decision, like, I'm going to, not to flee to a literal desert, but I'm going to flee to a lifestyle, a shift in the way I'm living so big that God is going to actually be in the center. It's like being a monk. I'm first a contemplative. I'm a monk who's active. I'm not living behind closed walls. I'm active in the world. You're in your job or in a church work or whatever you might be in, or momming or dadding at home to kids. But you got a role or a job you're doing, paid or unpaid. But deep underneath that, you realize I'm more than all of that. But my life is like David. I'm first a contemplative. You know, one thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, you know, to gaze upon his beauty and seek him in his temple. That was David, Psalm 27. That was like how he saw himself. And I feel like that's to stay in that pure place, or one will, one desire place, is really freedom. And then everything flows out of that. But it's a revolution to get there, because there's so much coming at us, you know, just so much every direction.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about is that someone could read Emotionally Healthy Spirituality and say, well, he had to go outside of Christianity to find its emotional health, right? But the truth is, I mean, certainly there's like some family system stuff, which I think we should see as a gift from God. But But the truth is like, no, actually, you had to go outside of American evangelicalism, but you went back to historic Christianity. You know, you talk about the Desert Fathers, you know, the monks, like these are all, this is all like very historical, very Orthodox Christianity.
Yes. And again, we're not the whole church.
Right.
We're part of the church. And I still would consider myself, you know, an Orthodox evangelical Christian. I love my tradition because I came to Christ in it. And we have many great strengths, you know, leading people to a relationship with Jesus, you know, scripture, a value of scripture, mobilizing people for mission. I wouldn't be here if someone didn't reach out to me with the gospel. So I have a lot of gratitude. At the same time, I'm not afraid to call out the blind spots in our tradition. There's blind spots. Every church has blind spots. We have ours. And but I need to learn from the whole. Again, I have friends in Africa or Latin America and Asia walking with Jesus. And so we can learn so much from each other outside of just our kind of narrow church. That's why it's important to be global. That's why in some ways that the era we're living in now is such a gift, because with technology, we're actually able to connect to people all over the world and have a wider lens of what's happening. And I have a friend in Africa, he emails me all the time. He goes, you got to help us here in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. We have, you know, there's more Christians here in Africa than there are any place else in the world, 613 million or something, 630 million. And they're expecting to have a billion by the year 2050. And he goes, you know, we are the gravity of the church has shifted. Again, you know, it used to be in, you know, the Mideast, and then it went to, you know, North Africa, then it was in Europe, and then it was in Britain, then it was in, you know, North America, and now it has shifted to Africa. And that's significant. You know, God is on the move. And so what can I learn from my brethren in Africa, you know, about following Jesus? It's wonderful.
That's so helpful, because you talk about, you know, getting out. One of the chapters is worshiping the crucified Jesus, not the Americanized Jesus, which I love. Speaking my heart language there. What makes that so hard is that's the water we swim in. And so we need to rub shoulders with our African brothers and sisters. And if there's something about our faith that looks weird to them, well, there's probably a good hint that came from America and not Jesus. And, you know, not that they don't have their own cultural factors at play, but, you know, that's so helpful. And I like what you said, that we're really lucky to be in this time where we can do that. We're also, you know, sometimes I catch myself saying like, oh, it's a pity that we're separated by 2,000 years of history between us and the early church, you know? But in reality, I think maybe that's a gift, because we've got the whole church history that we can, you know, read about and see how the Holy Spirit was speaking to different people at different times. And again, get out of our modern, you know, our white neoliberal Americanized version of the gospel.
Yeah. And I think out of that, we will have something to offer the world. That's a gift. Now, again, United States is we're the richest country in the world. We're still, you know, a superpower in the world. We have tremendous influence. And we have to steward that. Like we should all be concerned about vaccines getting to India, you know, and vaccines getting to the rest of the world. Like, so that's using our power and wealth and lobbying for, like, we got to give this away. Like, we're stewarding something. America has a lot to give away. And so it's not about building walls to keep people out. And I don't know about security issues. I can't speak to that. I'm not a, you know, national security person, but I do know that we're the wealthiest country in the world, and everybody in the world wants to come here. You know, we're in Queens, New York, which is one of the centers of immigration in the United States. You know, we have 2.4 million people here in Queens. Over two-thirds were born outside the country. So we're still around. Like, on our block, we're one of the few American-born people. I mean, there's probably, I don't know, say there's 75 people on our block, maybe five of us are born in the country.
You know? Yeah.
So, you know, everyone's speaking different languages. And everybody wants to get here. They're dying to get here because it's a great country. I mean, it's just, there's tremendous opportunity. But you can be poor and be driven by money, right? You can be poor on welfare, but your whole life is consumed by, I got to make it in America, you know? And so now you've thrown Jesus out the window too, because you've bought into the God of money and American success. And so one of these we have to teach is like, hey, no, you're not here for the American dream. You're here for Jesus. Okay. So if you're pursuing the American dream as your first goal in your life, you have left Jesus. You may be poor, but you have been seduced by a power and principality. And so you can, it comes from different angles, right? You have it, you want to hold on to it, or you don't have it, you want it so badly, right? So you're clinging to attachments. And so I love Meister Eckhart. He was a 12th century German Dominican. And he just wrote about how if you're attached, for him, following Jesus is about detachment. You have to let go of everything so that Jesus can fill you. But if you're not detached, like if you're clinging to stuff or you have to have something, like Jesus can't be birthed in and through your life, was his basic thesis. So Jerry and I, we were just talking this, you know, this morning, my wife, and we're talking about just, you know, we've been digging deeper into silence, really, in our own journey and letting go. You know, it's just working on letting go, you know, just silence for us is a deep place of surrender, of consenting to God's will. Mm. And it's like working out. Like I got to work out my spirit to like not be attached. We have four daughters. We got three grandchildren. We got two son-in-laws and we love our kids, but you can love them too much. You know, I love my wife. I love everything too much. And so it's letting go at all. And like, so that I'm not clinging anything and I'm just holding this, right? I'm present to whatever God wants to do, however he wants to do it, and a deeper and deeper interior freedom. You know, I'm living out of loving union with Jesus, out of which everything flows. And we're just finding we just need longer periods and deeper silence and stillness in our lives for the days we're living in.
So, you know, the new book is divided into two parts. And so the second part is like, okay, well, how do we foster this kind of healthy discipleship in our churches? And so I wonder if you could just, you know, briefly outline like how, when church leaders get a vision for this, like how do we actually bring this to fruition as a culture that lives within our church?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would, you know, so emotional discipleship kind of lays out in a book form, you know, what we're talking about. What are some of the marks of shifting a culture, a whole church culture, as well as my own personal life? And so it lays out some things like be before you do. You know, how do I know if I'm where my doing in life is being sustained by a being with God and being with myself? And then it goes into following the crucified, not the Americanized Jesus. And then things like receive God's gift of limits, you know, like embracing limits as a gift, which is very un-American. And then receiving, you know, then receiving God's treasures buried in grief and loss. Like that's why the pandemic is not like, we're almost at 600,000 people have died in our country alone. You know, someone said to me, all these people dying in India. Well, it's not my country. And I'm like, I know, but we're Jesus followers. Like we grieve what's going on in India right now. And there's treasures in grieving and loss. A whole book called Lamentations, the Bible. 2/3 of the Psalms are laments, and yet we don't do grief and loss. I mean, our churches is tragic. So learn to feel sadness and then making love the measure of actually maturity. Like this is how we measure. How's a person mature? And then how do I grow in loving people? And then talk about things like, you know, breaking the power of the past, genograms or family of origin stuff, and then leading out of brokenness and vulnerability. But I would say to people listening to your podcast, I mean, we've got some free stuff on our website that I think you got to do some stuff, you know, like there's some, like you can download some, whether it's team transformational videos on Sabbath or slowing down and, or genogram your family. And it's just free. You can just do it. We wanted to get people into it. There's a little survey. Am I an emotional infant, child, adolescent, or adult? Just take it, you know, assessment. Where am I on the spectrum? And it takes about 15, 20 minutes. It's free. But we got to get people in it. And I'd say, you know, we there's a course. It's 2 8-week courses. It's a very big thing that we try to get. We want the churches actually begin slowly doing. But we say don't do it unless you first live it. And, you know, because the church doesn't need a program. It needs a life lived in people.
Yeah.
And so we encourage leaders, like, do this course just for you. We've begun doing it for pastors because we realize pastors aren't living the basic stuff you want to bring into the church. So we're, the pandemic, one of the gifts has been doing a course for like a couple hundred pastors at a time through Zoom from like 17 countries. We realize they can't bring anything to church. They're not living it yet at all. They read a book, but so building rhythms in their life, again, of daily offices and Sabbaths and beginning to feel, integrate their feelings into discerning God's will and learning to grieve and learning some skills. And how do I love people? You know, how do I speak clearly, respectfully, and honestly? How do I resolve conflict that's clean, not dirty fighting? You know, and just getting people into some of this material. But most people, I mean, most pastors are so busy, they don't have time. They don't have time for their own discipleship.
Ironically.
So, it's ironic, isn't it? And so there's really not much we can do. I mean, what are we going to do? But I have hope. I mean, I see a lot of young people who really want multiracial churches. They have a passion for the poor, climate change, stewarding the earth. I mean, just it's a whole different place, you know? And so they don't know how to get there, but they have I think it's a God-given call for justice and it's God's heart. And so we want to meld them into communities. I think and they're very experiential. They want they love it. And actually, we're very popular among like 35 and under. Like I'm an old guy now. It's ironic that what we've been doing for a long time is suddenly fits the culture. You know, the next generation is. So I see a lot of young leaders, a lot of young people emerging, and I think you can do some really creative things and new wineskins, new forms mm-hmm. of church. It's exciting to me. I think the mega church is over as we know it. I don't see a big future for it personally. I know it doesn't fit in Texas, but I just don't see much of a future. I don't see much of a future for it. I think it'll be an American blip on a screen.
I have managed for whatever reason to not have much experience in the mega church world, but I have seen, I don't want to condemn them all, but I've seen so many mega church refugees that come out and are so wounded or jaded or you know, what have you. All those things, yes, can happen from in any size church, but I think there are particular weaknesses that come with trying to put on a big program every Sunday and all that entails.
And so I think there's a real longing for community, right? That young folks are longing for community. But if you're going to have community, healthy community, you need some good leadership. And so my concern is let's help those who want to lead help communities, because do you understand that that's like reparenting of people? How do I live in the new family of Jesus?
Yeah.
So they need some equipping. And so that's what I feel like is for Jerry and I, we want to give ourselves to help mentor the next generation, because God's given you visions and dreams for what could be. And, you know, there's just a couple pieces here you need about your own inner life, because you don't want to lead beyond your inner life. That's when you get into trouble.
Yeah.
And it's not sustainable and things blow up, but if you'll take your time and be patient, I think it'd be just wonderful.
Well, Pete, thank you for taking the time. And I'm gonna hold up the book one more time, get it wherever books are sold. Emotionally Healthy Discipleship and Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. And you mentioned you guys have done such a great job at providing so many resources, you know, workbooks and a bunch of free stuff, videos on your site. I'll be sure to put a link to your site on the show notes. And then in your podcast as well, and recently you've been going through through the book, kind of chapter by chapter, and so people can check that out as well.
Thanks, Shane. Thank you so much, Shane. I say you get the gold star for the best podcast title.
You'll never forget it.
Seminary Dropout. Thank you so much, Shane.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But